So how many of these did you guys get? I mean, since obviously those guys didn't get much of a cheer when they actually went with these crazy things, I thought I'll show it to you. These are CMU, these are apparently CMU grad students, and they took part in some local demonstration, and anyway there was a demonstration going on, so they made their own ones. So this, oh, this is a G20 summit, yeah, exactly. So support vector machines and Bayesians against discrimination and repeal power laws, free variables, and duality gap. I mean, this is all machine learning stuff, so you need to have a good idea of what's going on there. Ban genetic algorithms, and then this one says map reduce, map reuse, map recycle. So Greenpeace organization, I guess. Anyway, somebody sent me a copy, so I thought I'll show it to you. I don't think the G20, rest of the G20 guys had any clue what's going on, but at least hopefully you do. Okay, so what I am going to do today is hopefully complete the discussion on reinforcement learning. In particular, I'm going to do factored or propositional reinforcement learning methods. And relational reinforcement learning is at the cutting edge, and we won't even get there. Okay. So remember, there was atomic, propositional, relational. Okay. So what we'll do is relational, I mean, the propositional version are factored versions of reinforcement learning algorithms, how to do Q-learning, and also another idea called policy improvement search, policy search directly. You know, all of which in terms of propositional representation. Okay. So before I go forward, remember that I sent a mail saying you guys are supposed to put your project descriptions up. I think I gave a deadline, and you know, I hope you'll put them up by then, so that I can give you. I mean, if they have any major worries that this cannot be done or it's too easy, then I'll let you know. You know, within a week or so after that. It's a course project. What do you mean scope of project? So you essentially have to, I mean, it's extremely hard to tell what is within scope and what's not within scope. So for example, I would say getting a IIII paper is an upper end. IIII, ICAPS, or KR, any of them, you know, is an upper end, you know. So basically starting the groundwork for that would be a reasonable project. But it can also be directed surveys if you don't have any idea as to what you can do yourself. You know, it can be theoretical, it can be implementation oriented, it can be survey oriented. I think theoretical and implementation are higher than survey oriented, mostly because writing a good survey is actually much harder than you people normally assume, because you need to read a lot of things and really figure out what's going on. And also, that's partly, to some extent, that's the thing that we're going to exercise in the presentations one. Okay. Yes. It can, but you can't say a presentation is the project, or that survey. I mean, if you present it and then that survey, the written version of the presentation is the project, that won't work. Okay. There were two, I think, in the there were two actually, which some 574. There were two projects which eventually became. Let me give you an example. So one project was this was all about planning, automated planning techniques. And so one project was trying to learn user preferences as hierarchical task networks. I didn't teach you this, so you may or may not understand this. And then Nan Lee, a student in 574, did that project, and she obviously went probably like one third of the way by the end of the class, and then eventually she completed it, and it was an Ichikai 2009 paper. Okay. And similarly, another student, Tuan, did some work on finding diverse plans when you have partial information, And then that too, he was done about a third by the end of the class, and then he had a paper in each guy. Paper in each guy, I can't expect. But eventually good term papers might go somewhere. Another project that I remember, I had good memories of, in the sense the student got a very high grade, is they took a specific paper from ICAPS 2007, I think, which essentially was, if you have, so there is this idea that if you are, in some cases what happens is, the specific problem they were solving is, you can try to solve a planning problem by first assuming what's the length of the plan, guess the length of the plan, set up an encoding such that, it can be a SAT encoding, such that an answer to the SAT encoding, if there is an answer to the SAT encoding, it would be a plan of that length K. And so then you can basically, you would say loop for I from, 1 to infinity, call one of these encodings, solve it. If you can solve it, then you have a plan. If not, increment the encoding. This is in some sense how graph plan actually worked. And there was an interesting question as to what's the optimal way. So obviously, what's the best way to do this incrementing? Should you go 1, 2, 3, 4, or should you go 1, 2, 4, 8, 16? Do you want to do binary search? Do you want to do linear increment? Do you want to go back, forward and then come backward? And what is the optimal scheduling strategy for these encodings? And there was a work on that on ICAPS 2007. And this student essentially tried to find a slightly better variation of what was done in that paper. Those were some of the good ones I know. I think it's completely fine to find something that is in the intersection of what you are already interested in and what this course is supposed to be dealing with. You don't have to just look at what has been done till now. There are other things that we'll be doing. Plus, if it is within the general area of AI, that's fine. I know that one of the students actually said they're interested in, I think you, right? You're interested in effect and basically modeling of emotions and effect and so on. That's fine with me. As long as there are, there's work being done in that area and you want to make your project on that, it's fine. Okay, so other questions? I'm assuming that most of you have been thinking about it already and that this is not the first time you thought about it, because if you, this is the first time you thought about it, you're probably in trouble. So any other questions on this? So one thing that I want to mention is last class there was a question as to what happens, this is a TD lambda, and we pointed out that TD lambda essentially can be thought of as a particular way of doing weighted average of a huge number of backups. So here is a one backup, and you weight it by 1 minus lambda, and here is a two level backup, you weight it by 1 minus lambda times lambda, here is a three backup, 1 minus lambda times lambda square, and so on. And all the way to, let's say this one is the terminal state. You hit the terminal state in the tth iteration. And so what you would think is that there should be 1 minus lambda times some number here. However, you notice that there is a lambda power, t minus 1. So the 1 minus lambda is missing. Now, actually, it's good that it's missing, because it's missing, for lambda equal to 0, then all of these will become zero, and only this will work, this backup will work, which means for TD lambda with lambda equal to zero is exactly temporal difference learning, TD one step learning. Now if lambda equal to 1, that was the question that was asked last time, if lambda equal to 1, it looks like all of these will become zero. Actually, this does not become zero. because there is no 1 minus lambda. Okay, so everything else becomes 0 except this guy. And this guy, if you just take that backup, that's exactly like taking the Monte Carlo backup, right? That's exactly what a Monte Carlo does. It goes all the way to the terminal state. Now, the question, of course, is why did I put this here? Does it make sense to put, you know, no 1 minus lambda here? Actually, there is a method to the madness. It wasn't like, it wasn't a, you know, opportunistic thing, you know. Basically, what you want to think of is you hit a terminal state here. After you hit the terminal state, if you keep doing any action, you will stay in the same state, essentially. So you can imagine that there are infinitely more backups after this. All of them are of this length. But each of those backups is being discounted by one more lambda factor. Right? So if you take this, you know, if you take this sum as the common factor, then you get another infinite sequence in terms of lambdas, lambda square, lambda cube, etc., whose summation will be 1 by 1 minus lambda. And that 1 by 1 minus lambda cancels out the other 1 minus lambda. Okay? So that's the way to understand what actually happened. You know, it's very useful that, in fact, it becomes Monte Carlo on this side and temporal difference on this side. But the reason actually it happens is because I was supposed to write infinite number of these backups. But after this, every one of these backups remains the same because that's a terminating state. Okay? Yes?
So here we do not define the t, but it is from the sync state?
What? This is for the sync state. If there is no sync state, then that's an interesting question. If there is no sync state, what does Monte Carlo do? Monte Carlo goes all the way to infinite. Okay? And are in essence, at some point of time, going below certain level, you won't change the precision of the value.
And then based on that, we can
define that you can think of that as the effective terminal state.
Okay?
Okay, so that's something that I just wanted to bring back because there was a question and you know, I didn't deal with it well last time.
Another question is that so all of these are actually one trace only.
What?
All of these are actually one trace only, but we separate into different ones with the.
Yeah, so you had a big trace, but you're using pieces of it separately. So you essentially just did one Monte Carlo backup. So this is actually what happens. That's what this guy is showing. So if you essentially, one of the interesting things is that, so you have a sequence from, so basically that to that. That's the sequence you experienced. You just considered this here, considered this here, considered this here, and then you consider all of them at the same time. Now, what's another interesting thing, of course, is that actually while you are doing it for one step, so you started with S0, S1, etc., up to ST. So you not only can actually compute the weighted backups for S0, you can also compute weighted backups for S1 because it has, you know, from S for S1, this is the sequence. And similarly, weighted backup for S2 and so on. And what happens, interestingly, is that if you're using TD lambda, so here is like a picture it's basically showing that in a one-step TD, you'll only know what is the right thing to do in the last state. What is the right thing to do in the last state correctly. Whereas this one, it will definitely know what's the right thing to do in the last state, but it also biases in the other places too. It biases the correct action. It gives it a little boost. Q values of those actions get a boost. So in a way, so the idea that if I have a sequence of this length, I can use this not only to update S0, but also to S1, etc. That's an obvious idea. You can use it for TD one step or TD lambda. Okay, but then in the case of TD one step, it doesn't really help. Only guy who really benefits by a one step backup is the last guy, because everybody else is still in the wrong. You know, they could have gone any direction. This is like the value iteration. Remember, the values of the states that are next to the sync state will converge before the values of the states farther away from the sync state. But in this case, because you are looking at all of them. So in this case, so even S0 will look at a sequence that ends in ST. not just the sequence that ends in S0 to S1, which is what TD1 would have done. Because of which, although of course the sequence that ends in ST will have a lower weight than the sequence that ends in S1. Okay? So because of which, essentially, you get this, you know, nice picture that the actions very close to the sync state are pretty much, you know, which is the best action, because their Q values dominate the other guy's Q values by a good magnitude. The actions away from that, they will only be slightly dominating. Okay, what this essentially means is, you know, what this essentially means is that here upward action is slightly, has a slightly higher Q value than left, right, and down actions. Whereas here, this one pretty much has the biggest Q value by a big margin. Okay? So that's basically about TD lambda and how you are using the experience. Okay? Yes? SARSA is Q learning. Think of it that way. You know, that's one more name that's used in the the Sutton book. Okay. So we talked about TD learning. Of course, this is TD lambda, and after that we talked about Q learning. And the idea of Q learning essentially is to update the Q values rather than the values of the states. So instead of a Q value of a state, instead of a single value of state where there are n states, you now, if there are you know, m actions per state and there are n states, then you have n times m q values, and for each state you will get m q values corresponding to the value you would get by doing any one of the m actions, and then the value of the state itself is the max of the q values, right? And then you can essentially do the same exact kind of updating for q values as you did for values. Q values are values already. It's just they split the value function into, you know, multiple, you know, one for each action. And what was the reason Q learning was supposed to be better than TD learning? Yeah, because the point is, even if I find out what is the optimal policy using the TD lambda, I'm sorry, optimal value using the TD lambda, how do I know what is the action to take? If I give you the optimal value function, I'm supposed to be able to find you the optimal policy, but that assumes that you do have the model. Model is the actions and their probabilities, but I don't have that. Okay? So it looked as if you need to suddenly become model based. You can't be model free. Right? And then we said, no, that's not the case. In fact, at the expense of tracking, you know, m times more quantities, where m is the number of actions per state, you don't need to know any model anymore. You just remember the q values, and then for each state, the action to do is, for each state, the value is the max of its q values, and the action to do is the action corresponding to the q value that was the maximum. And you still don't need to know, I mean, in doing this, you still don't know what is the probability that if you do this action in this state, you will get to this state with, what probability will you get to this state? You don't know that number. And so you don't know the model. This is still model free. Okay? So that's Q learning. We talked about Q learning. And one of the interesting things, of course, is that just as we talked about ADP, you know, which is adaptive dynamic programming, Q learning too, since it's essentially remember in the ADP we talked about the fact that if I have the value, and since I have the model in the case of ADP, I can compute the policy using the best policy using policy evaluation. It's the best policy using greedy value optimization, right? However, as long as I have the value and the model, I can actually get the optimal. I mean, I can do the same thing, but actually instead of solving the policy evaluation linear equations, I can solve the optimal value function, nonlinear equations, which involve the max. And if I do that, I will get optimal policy right away. And that looked great, except I said that the problem, of course, is if the model that you have in your hand might be partial model. Because if you remember, we went here and basically you only got the model for this part, and you never really reached these states, and so you don't know the model for those states, because of which you could potentially lose. So the optimal policy when you only have this much model is going to be different from the optimal policy when you have the entire model. Okay, and so of course the question is, when do you know that you've gotten the entire model? The only idea that we had at that time is do exploration. So try not to be greedy. Try not to always pick the action based on the policy. Okay, and so we can actually put a little bit more teeth into that idea here. Where are we? Okay, I'll come back to those things, but we'll put some teeth into this by essentially saying, okay, so here are some strategies essentially for deciding when to do non-greedy action. A greedy action is the one that is optimal with respect to the current value function, a current Q value function. But the current Q value function could be inoptimal to begin with. It's not exhaustive. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in the case of ADP, we said, I didn't know the model of the higher up guys. In this case, what I don't know is all the Q values. So for example, what happened when you come to the Q learning is that, sorry to go back and forth, but so in the case of ADP, I didn't know what are the probabilities that an action will get you to these states and what happens in those cases. That's what we didn't know. Now, when you go to Q learning, you don't have actions. We don't think about action probabilities. And yet, I could be incomplete in the sense that my Q value functions are incomplete. Because, for example, I may know for a given state, I may know 7 Q values. And I just take the max of those Q values and take the action with respect to that. But what if 7 is less than the total number of actions that could be done from that state? There are 10,000 actions that can be done from that state. You only know 7 of them. Among the 7, you know you did the best. How do you know that, 10,000 minus 7, one of those actions will get you to a much better state? You understand what I'm saying? So in fact, the advantage is that Q values actually allow you to, defining a value of a state in terms of max, argmax of Q value of doing an action A in the state A. An advantage of defining it this way is even if there are 10,000 actions and I only know 7 Q values, I still know what's the best value for my state given what I know. Okay, so what is wrong in the Q learning will now be the Q values themselves. I don't have some of the Q values. Some of the existing Q values might be wrong, and a whole bunch of Q values I don't even know. And so essentially, I need to do those actions that are not being done to get that extra information. Okay, so what are the ways we can do those non-greedy actions? So in the case of, Q learning, non-greedy means picking an action whose Q value is not the highest. Okay, so we can imagine in our 10,000 action case, we can imagine that the rest of the actions are all Q values are initialized to zero, let's say. Then so the rest of those actions have zero Q value and some of them have some positive Q value, and so you are basically just keeping picking them up, taking the max of those. Okay, so where did I go here? Okay, so what I can do is that essentially one idea is epsilon greedy, which says with the probability epsilon, I act randomly, and probability 1 minus epsilon, I act according to my current policy, which for Q learning, pick the max of the Q values. This is a reasonable idea. The problem with this, as I was mentioning at the end of last class, is you're doing random actions for the heck of doing random actions. Okay? What if the random action you are picking is an action that you have shown to yourself as a really bad action? So here are 7 actions. Okay? One has plus 10, plus 1, plus 4, minus 300, plus 2. Okay, let's say. And then there are some more actions which are 0. Okay, now if with probability epsilon, I might actually pick the minus 300 action, right? Because when I pick a random action, I might pick a minus 300 action. So that it looks as if that's already been shown to be a bad action. Why am I wasting time trying to, do that action multiple times? The real question, what we want to ask, is how do we know that an action's Q value has sort of stabilized? When was the last time we thought about it? LRTDP. Except in the case of LRTDP, so again, keep making a comparison between what we were doing in LRTDP and here. In the case of LRTDP too, we wanted to know when is the value of a state stabilized, in which case it's considered solved. And similarly, here we want to know when is the Q value stabilized, so that I don't need to do that action. Okay. Yeah. See, again, Q learning is still value learning, except instead of doing value, you do, n values. Instead of learning n values, you learn n times m Q values, such that the values are defined in terms of Q values. You better get this completely straight in your heads, all your heads, because Q learning is just a more finer grained way of doing value learning. Right? Which update?
Your tip question.
Oh, okay.
You said
I was talking about LRTDP versus this.
Versus TD.
TD, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So some of the responses from
said
something about the conversion. And
so the interesting, of course, the difference, the major difference between LRTDP as we learnt it and TD is that in one case we had the model staring at us. We had the entire model staring at us in the case of LRTDP. It was just our intellectual laziness that, so if you just computed, the value in the Bellman equations, you knew the values of everybody. Here, even if you did the Bellman equation, all the way, you still don't know. Basically, it's like ADP basically could have found the optimal policy given its partial value function. And the partial model, and the optimal value, an optimal policy for partial model is not the optimal policy overall. So that's like a huge, much bigger difference between TD on one hand and LRTDP on the other. In one case, you don't have the information before you started. In the other case, all the information is up there. It's like chess. You have the rules of chess completely known beforehand. All we are doing is essentially unrolling what should be obvious. But that's computationally, pretty costly thing to do still. But, whereas in this case, so in some sense, in chess, you can simulate. You don't need to look into the world at all. There's nothing that you will learn by playing chess that you can't learn by thinking about chess. See, if there is something you can learn by playing chess that you can't learn by thinking about chess, that only thing that you're learning is about human nature, which is not about chess. It's like you might learn that certain kinds of people can be easily bluffed. That is something that you can learn. Russians can't be bluffed. Hungarians, it's easy to bluff them. That you could learn. But everything else, you could just sit down with the rules of chess and simulate and figure out what's the optimal choice, if you don't want to lose the game. That's all you want to do. Yeah, so that's what we're going to do now. So the idea then, essentially, all we will say is we'll never be sure. Unlike in LRTDP, where we are know for sure when you have converged, because you know that I got my value from a terminal state on one side, and all other guys have already upper bounds I mean, so all their costs, the lower bound costs are already worse than what I'm getting from the terminal state. And as the value iteration goes on, their values will only become worse. So I can never get anything better from them. This is the argument in LRTDP. It's a branch and bound argument. Okay? You cannot do branch and bound argument in exploration. All you can do is, look, I've been here enough times. I just been here enough times. So let me be somewhere else. Okay? So to do that, in essentially what you do is you make Q values corresponding to actions that haven't been tried long enough, and corresponding to state action pairs that haven't been tried large enough number of times, okay, you make them artificially look tempting to the exploration, to the executor. Okay, so the idea is, suppose the real Q values, suppose I have a state S1, you know, so S1 A1, the Q value of that is, 1.0, S1 A2 is 2.5, S1 A3 is 0, let's say these are the only three actions. For now, let's forget about the 10,000 actions. Okay, now, obviously, I would have just picked this, if I'm executing at this point. But suppose I have kept a counter, and the counter says, in the entire number of episodes that I have done till now, I have done S1, A3. That means when I was in S1, I did A3 zero times till now. I never did it. Whereas this one, I did it five times. This one, I did it one time. So that means this zero is not based on experience at all. It's just based on, I think it'll be zero. Or, even if it is, basically this is based on less experience than this. So the ones that you have experienced fewer times, you want to artificially boost their value. How do you do that? So you say, this is the estimate, the current estimate, and for all of them, you add a k by n factor, where k is the big number that you're trying to add to the q value, but n is the number of times you have already seen this state action pair. And so, if you have seen it only zero times, then basically it actually becomes infinity. But let's assume that, you'll make it one plus. Okay? So if you assume that everything has been seen once, then at most you will increase the Q value by a quantity K. But if you've seen it like 10 times, you'll only increase it by a quantity K by 10. If you've seen it 1,000 times, you increase it only by K by 1,000 times. And so at some point of time, essentially, over infinite exploration, right, every state has been, every state action pair has been tried infinitely, this will become zero. So it only is in the short term you make untried actions, untried state action pairs look, compellingly, look enticing, and then in the long term they become just, their intrinsic value will win. Yeah, this is balancing exploration and exploitation. It's exactly balancing exploration and exploitation. What this basically means is when you're in your childhood, you should be exploring more. As you become as old as me, you should explore less. And, at some point of time, you don't explore at all. Maybe you don't even exploit. That's a different story. But, as you live long enough, essentially, the counter for every state and action would increase, so that you are less likely to do exploration. Of course, you'll still do exploration for those states that you never even tried once. Okay? So that's basically the advantage of this. And so now it's the same Q learning, except certain Q values have been artificially made to look better than what they really are. And so the executor is going to do those actions. And when it does the action, the way you reset the Q values, the way you reset the Q values is using Q learning, normal Q learning. Okay? So this is the interesting thing. So the original one was in terms of Q values itself. Now it's in terms of function of Q value and the number of times you have done the F dash A dash, which this function has the property that if the number of times you've done f dash a dash is very large, then it will be equal to q. And the specific way it becomes equal to q is less important, as long as it falls with respect to the number of visits to the state action, you can prove. And when I say you can prove, I'm not proving here that this thing will actually, in the limit, asymptotically converge to the optimal policy and optimal value. And it's better than the previous idea of epsilon, because things that are already really bad. So in fact, I mean, it's better in some ways, in the sense it's not just going to do random actions, it's only going to do actions that you haven't tried before. You can improve this exploration policy even more. You can also, for example, say that you could, for example, one of the things you are doing here is you're only counting the number of visits to the state. Consider the following thing. Suppose I visited, I have two states, both of, so I have S1A1 and S1A5 and S1A7, both of them have n equal to 7. That means they both have been visited exactly 7 times. Okay? However, suppose the value of S1 has changed drastically. I mean, the Q value has changed drastically in the past 7 iterations, whereas this one is pretty much stable. That basically means this guy is still not, you know, among these, I want to break the tie such that this guy gets more preference. So in a way, that is taking the bounds, not just the Q value, but also the bounds of the Q value. How high did it go? How low did it go? And using the bounds. And there is another interesting idea called UCB, which is upper confidence bound based exploration. And it works wonders in many games, for example. Okay, so all I'm saying is this is one idea which is better than epsilon idea. Epsilon is just, you know, epsilon probability do random thing, otherwise do one of the greedy thing. This one is saying count the number. On top of it, you can say not only count the number, see how much the value is changing. That's another thing you could do. But the tricky issue is for each of them proving. I mean, I'm not showing it here, but proving. You know, somebody has to prove it once so that rest of us can just use it. Okay? Proving that a certain policy of exploration will actually converge to the optimal policy. What? No, there are conditions under which, if you know the bounds, you know, essentially, if you, for example, know that nobody's value, I mean, first of all, if you know that the values are bounded, let's say, and you know the highest and the lowest anybody can take, then sometimes you can get away without having to look at the entire state space. Okay. The other thing, you know, another idea related to this is essentially you would avoid trying the state that are already proven to be pretty negative. Okay. One of the interesting things in the entire Q learning as a whole, and this actually becomes even clearer when we get to the policy search, is in the case of Q learning, you in a way are still talking about actually converging to the optimal Q value. If I were to give you a thing which doesn't converge to optimal Q value but does converge to optimal policy, do you care? Because all you need to know is what's the right action to do. You don't need to know how much better is the right action to the next right action, the next best action. So in general, this was the reason we said value iteration tends to converge slower than the policy iteration. Because policy, there are only finite number of policies and you just jump from one to other and you exhaust them much before the value iteration slowly reaches zero error. Okay, and in essence, some of these issues would be trying to make sure that the relative ranking between the Q values is not going to change. If it doesn't change, then you are happy. Then, you know, you don't need to do any more exploration. And this becomes even more obvious in the policy search, where you say to heck with the Q learning. We don't even care about actually making a pretense of converging to the optimal Q values. We'll just directly look for the optimal policy using reinforcement learning. So basically, policy search, which by the way is what, I mean, for if you need an a reason to kind of think about it, policy search is what that upside down helicopter used. Okay? And so directly searching in the space of policies using reinforcement learning techniques, there you don't, all you care about is the relative dominance of the Q values. That's all you care about, not the correct values. And you know, many a time, you know, relative dominance, you can, you know, I think many, how many of you know this paradox about naive-Bayes classifiers? Naive-Bayes classification gets the probabilities wrong, really, really wrong, because it assumes every, you know, if you're thinking in terms of classification, it assumes all features are independent given the class label, which is not true in most you know, scenarios. And yet, naive-Bayes classifier works quite well in many, many cases. And in the beginning, people were wondering, why the heck is this happening? And it turns out that what naive-Bayes classifier is bad at is getting the right probabilities. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it will also get the wrong class probability. So for example, if in fact, you know, you're trying to, you know, if, you know, a random example is positive with true probability of 0.9 and negative with a true probability of 0.1, naive-Bayes classifier said 0.51 and 0.49, it's clearly way off in terms of the real probabilities. And yet the decision is the same. Both the NBC and the true probability guy will say the correct label for this random example is positive. Okay? And that kind of gives you a leeway. You know, you can basically, this is kind of connected to the point that you would start doing the right decisions much before you get to the right value function. You would start doing the optimal decisions often much before you get to the optimal value function, because optimal decisions only need the value dominance, the Q value dominance. Okay, so that's all I'm going to say about acceleration. Okay, yes.
I have a question about the K value in your acceleration.
Yeah, that's one way of doing it. You know, it's basically any function of the current Q value and the number of trials that you have made for that state and that action. And the only requirement I have is that this function in the limit where n becomes infinity should become this value. That's all I want. When n becomes infinity, the f of these two numbers should be the first number. So f of 5 and x should be 5 when x is infinity. That's all I care, really. And it should just start off monotonically. I mean, one reasonable thing is to make it monotonically become close to 5. It starts with 10, let's say. So 5 plus 5, and as the number of things, number of trials increase, it just keeps falling towards 5. Okay? Okay, so that's about Q learning. I'm about to leave the atomic approaches now. And before I do that, I want to go back and show you these slides, which I will put later on, you know, after this. But essentially, let's do it. Okay. So we talked about the fact that ultimately all the atomic reinforcement learning methods differ. In one way they differ is in terms of backups. Okay? And the backups could be based, they could be full backups. That means you consider all the alternatives from that state, so all the actions from that state, or they could be sample-based backups. That means you just see what the sample told you, that's all. You don't care about what other actions are there. Now, even within full backups, you could be doing policy evaluation, which is passive reinforcement learning, where among this, you see it as an R branch. So you'll only consider the action that you're taking. So let's say this is the action you're taking, then you compute its expected value. Right? Whereas here, you took this action, only this happened. So you don't even consider that something else could have happened. Now notice that this, the fact that there are two here, that's just an arbitrary picture here. In fact, under each action there can be 10,000 states. Okay, and so a policy-based backup picks the action and considers all possible states that it could have taken to and backs up based on that. A sample-based one picks the action, asks the world to tell it exactly what happened in this case, this one time, and only backs up with respect to that sample. So even for policy, it's much cheaper, right? Now, if in fact it's not based on, so if you're doing actually value iteration, that means if you're actually computing the optimal policy, not just policy evaluation, like the ADP can compute optimal policy, then you need to not only consider, you have to basically consider all actions and take the max over the expectations of each of the actions. So that's why in the backup diagram we'll put an AND. That means you have to consider all actions. Not that you're doing all of them, you have to consider all of them during the backup step. So this backup is cheaper than this. And both of them are costlier than that. Right? Okay. And then these were with respect to values, and the same thing can be done with respect to Q values instead of values. That's one dimension, which is the way you do the backup. It turns out there is another dimension. So the dimension that we talked about is dynamic programming, which basically does one step look ahead and considers all the options, all the actions and all the possible states and backs up. If it's policy, it backs up only over one branch, and if it is, you know, optimal policy, it has to back up on all of them. And temporal difference learning, which takes one sample. That's one dimension. Okay? So sample-based backup, full backup. The other question is, why should you go only one level? Okay? You could do exhaustive backup. So for example, in dynamic programming, instead of just going one level, you could go k levels deep and then backup. Now, what's the difference between this and this? What do you think will be the difference? Yeah, but I mean, what's the good point of it? Why would I care about this? No. If I use this backup instead of this backup in my ADP, what would happen to the ADP? What? It's optimal anyway. If you use this backup, the number of backups needed would be much fewer.
Yes.
But each backup would be exponentially costly. If you use this backup, essentially this is what has been done in the real value iteration. It looks at, so one of the things that's sort of hard to understand, you know, that's easy to miss, is that the original value iteration algorithm was only looking at its neighbors. And if your neighbors have bad values, in one iteration, I too will get a bad value. Because of which, in fact, in the value iteration, remember I showed you that sometimes some state values will go down before they converge to the right value. Because in the beginning, everybody around me is having worse and worse estimates. And then finally, the good news travels to the guys close to the terminal states, who then will, you know, in the next iteration will tell their friends, who will then tell their friends, who will tell their friends, and eventually it will reach guys at the start state, I mean, and far away from the goal state. Right? And so it takes more backups, each of small time. Here you do a few backups, and basically, essentially, if you are hitting everybody, if everybody here is terminal, then you are actually getting the true values in one iteration. So in between, this is one step, this is exhaustive, there could be k step look ahead. This is sort of like game trees. You know, game tree can go one step all the way or k ply look ahead. Now, this exhaustiveness dimension doesn't have to be just for the dynamic programming, it can also be for the temporal difference learning. So along this dimension, temporal difference learning becomes Monte Carlo, if you go all the way. Right? And so in fact, temporal difference learning is more closer to dynamic programming than you may have realized. Both of them just look at their neighbors. Whereas at least this guy knows all the neighbors he has. This guy only sees the neighbor that happened because of the toss of that time. Neither of them look multiple levels ahead. Here you look multiple levels ahead. Okay, so that's like the spectrum of reinforcement learning approaches in the atomic case. And you should know what's good about what. What's good about what? I mean, in general, it's obvious that good stuff is in the middle, right? But in general, you need to know at least what are the trade-offs of each kind of idea. Okay? And in fact, I guess the lambda for, you know, if lambda is equal to, if you do TD lambda, for lambda equal to 1, it becomes this, and lambda equal to 0, it becomes this. So lambda in between, it must be somewhere in between. Okay, we haven't really explored the ones for dynamic programming that way, because in general, nobody seriously believes that DP-based updates are worth the time. The idea is, again, this is a classic case. It could be wrong. It turns out this could be a wrong bias. But the bias that everybody has in general in search is you should always reduce per node cost. Okay, which is one of the reasons why when heuristic search started, people would look at heuristics that can be very easily evaluated. Okay, but just because you have a cheap heuristic doesn't mean that the overall search complexity has reduced. Okay, again, it's this, where's the middle? Where is the minimum? Okay, so the general bias in reinforcement learning community is that the backups, individual backups, should not take too long because the agent should respond to the stimuli it's getting. So you take a stimulus and then say, I'll take 3 years off and figure out what I learned till now, and I'll come back and do my first action, which is exactly what this guy would do. But when he does, when you do it, you're right. But then everybody else will start panicking. You know, it's like there are people who have kids, you know, including my own kid, when, you know, the books will say the kids will start talking when they are certain such age. My son wasn't talking. And so I was, you know, searching. In fact, you search Google for RAW and language acquisition, you'll find some, you know, question I sent to a language learning list at one point of time. Okay? He wasn't talking, and I was worried. What the heck was he doing? You know, what, should we do something? And, you know, of course, it turns out that his backup was more exhaustive. You know, I think I may have told you this story that, you know, in my home, I speak Telugu. At least at that time, I was trying to speak to him in Telugu, which is my language. My wife speaks to him in Bengali, which is a completely different Indian language, and they have very little in common. And so he was essentially having his work cut out, trying to figure out which language to pick. And then he waited until he went to a Montessori school, where he found a reasonable majority, which is more than two people, are speaking this crazy language called English. So then he started speaking that. And this is not just for him. In fact, I have seen in that language acquisition list, they also pointed out that there are kids who are brought up in trilingual homes. I don't know what the heck is trilingual home, but apparently there are trilingual homes. And the kids will just wait until they're 3 years old and start talking fluently in all three languages. That's what they're doing, in some sense. Okay. Of course, it also means that the parents are busily, you know, stopping doing any work and sending letters to various, you know, lists saying, you know, is my kid okay? Or in general, if your agent does this, you know, okay, you gave me a stimulus, let me take 2 years off and figure out what to do next, right? Then you'll be thinking, you know, you'll hit on the computer. Is anything going on, you know? So just to avoid that, we tend to go for shallow backups. It's not necessarily that this is any better. I mean, this is any, you know, theoretically worse, but you just want some sort of a feedback to be given to people. I mean, if all that was needed really is for my kid to say, I'm thinking, guys, leave me alone. Right? If he said that, then I wouldn't have wrote that letter to the language list. But unfortunately, he didn't tell me that. You know, I guess he needed a language to tell me that, but, you know, whatever. Anyway, yes. None, I know. I mean, there are ones which do K, you know, higher level K. But in general, there are very few reinforcement learning systems that do full backups. Because in some sense, remember, if you look at the textbook, which you did read the chapter, you know, many weeks back when I started the reinforcement learning, that guy, you know, Russell points out that ADP is the gold standard with respect to which everybody else is compared. That means even this is not really done by most implemented reinforcement learning systems. This is considered too hard. And imagine this. So this is the gold standard for this. Okay? But again, it's worth knowing the spectrum of approaches and why people try those. You know, that's the thing I was trying to say. Okay. Any questions? Yes. No, if you had a model, it could be a partial model, but you have a model. You see, again, this is, remember this picture. Oh, there are too many pictures, but this picture. If you have a model, then you can use the model to do planning. You are talking about this. Direct experience will only give you one action and its outcome. But if you had also converted the experience over many iterations into a model, then you can use the model to do planning. Which one? No. Q learning is still considered in this because model, I mean, it's actually worth understanding that model basically talks about an action and its outcomes, probabilistic outcomes. It looks as if Q-learning is already giving me the names of the actions. Names of the actions are not the issue. The issue is whether you have the model of the actions. And if you have the model of the actions, you can do ADP. Without it, you can't do ADP.
The probabilities don't they correlate with the Q-value?
Yes. But the question is, am I ever taking time to compile the model or not? The point about this picture is I can live without this. So why do I need the model? And one of the interesting points actually is that oftentimes models can be more compact than the Q learn, and the Q values are the value function. This is actually a good segue into my next topic. Okay, we've been basically happily living in this world of tabular Q value functions, tabular value functions, tabular policy functions, everything. Okay, and so the size of the value function increases in the size of the state space. Size of the Q value function increases in the size of the state space times the number of actions. At some point of time, these things are going to be enormous. This is huge tabular representation. And if you remember in 471, we looked at, you know, we sort of, you know, didn't like tabular representation. Reflex agent can be written by tabular representations. And we said, tables will never scale up. Eventually, you need a way of, you know, having, you know, a representation of how the world evolves rather than just examples of how it evolved in the past.
Wouldn't it make sense, they would never have that, you know, model.
No, but they can learn again. So in fact, one of the interesting questions, since you brought up the Alzheimer's issue, the issue is what do Alzheimer's patients forget?
They don't have memory.
No. They do establish new long-term memories, depending on, again, I'm not a doctor, you know, I don't know whether you are, but, you know, I am Dr. Rao, but, you know. But the thing is that they do lose many long-term memories, but they don't lose the ability to generate long-term memories. They don't necessarily. In fact, it's like, how many of you know this case of what's her name? The Arizona Chief the Supreme Court Justice from Arizona. What's her name? Sandra Day O'Connor. So what happened to Sandra Day O'Connor? This is the stuff of gossip magazines, but for the fact that it was sad. So she retired out of the Supreme Court at the peak of her career because her husband was Alzheimer's and she was going to take care of him. Right? And then she came to Arizona and this guy essentially joined, he was in a hospice, he was in a kind of a nursing home kind of a thing, and he has made a new relationship with this other lady because he has forgotten everything else about his past. You might say this is just, men's way of making new, convenient excuses, but in this guy's case, it's a watertight excuse. He really forgot that he was related to Sandra Day O'Connor. So he was generating a new relationship, and you can't have a new relationship if every day you have to say, who are you? So he at least knew this other woman. Do you understand what I'm saying? So he has generated a new model of his world. It's just that Sandra Day O'Connor is no longer part of that model. She seems to be some random person that shows up and, every once in a while. And you will learn about her starting then, but whatever the memories that you have of them before, those are gone. And there is an equivalent opposite version of brain injury. In fact, I think there was a patient who died beginning of this year, and he was very famous because essentially he had beautiful long-term memories up until his 35th year. And he still remembers exactly what happened until his 35th year. After that, he completely lost the ability to generate models. Okay? And so in his case, it's a different issue. He would just keep saying hello every time he sees you, but anybody he knew from in his first 35 years of your life, he still remembers. Okay? Now, of course, this, as interesting as this might sound, at least to me, this is not really the distinction we want to make here. Model free doesn't mean memory free. Do you understand what I'm saying? Model free does not mean memory free. Reinforcement learning has to remember. What is it remembering? It's remembering the Q values. Instead, a model-based approach will just remember the action model and compute the Q values as needed. The real question one becomes the size, and that's where we'll go now. Where am I? In large state spaces, if you have the, in a small enough state space, you don't say, I don't care whether the model, remember model or remember, Q values. It's not, one of them is 1 megabyte, one of them is 3 megabytes, what's the big deal? Okay. But in large state spaces, you could require like terabytes and petabytes of memory to just remember the model, the Q value function. And yet, might only need a couple of kilobytes to remember the action. And furthermore, once you start talking about approximating, you take a Q value and you want to approximate a Q value representation, which is 3 petabytes, I give it to you. Reduce it to 2 kilobytes. How do you do it? You can't just say, I'll take this first few rows and columns and leave everything else. Whereas here is a set of actions. Each of them seem to have 29 probabilistic outcomes. Reduce their complexity. I'll take the most likely outcome. We'll just make one outcome each. That's an approximation. Bad approximation, but an approximation. 5 most likely outcomes. So the idea is representation of actions will allow you eventually to, in fact, take a smaller, you can provide a more approximate, you can provide a more compact representation. Now, the other issue about compactness is compactness also means generalizability, oftentimes. Okay? So if there is a way of representing something without having to put each value in a different cell of the table, then if you have 10,000 cells in a table and you just learned 9,999 of them, you have no idea what is a 10,000 cell is going to have, because I can do anything in it. If on the other hand I said these 10,000 cells of this table are going to be populated by a certain function, and here are 900 values that function takes for 900 of the cells. When you try to fit this function to those values, you in essence have made predictions about what the values of the rest of the 10,000 cells are. That's machine learning. I mean, that's basically the other machine learning that you knew already before you came here. This is machine learning too. Okay? But they both have to come hand in hand. Representations will allow you to generalize. Models will allow you to generalize. Okay? So basically, even if we had, first there is a problem of memory, and even if we had enough memory, never enough training data to be able to generalize. You need, you know, if you have 10,000 cells and you don't know anything other than that 10,000 cells have numbers in them, you need a large number of, basically you need 10,000 training, you know, examples at least. Okay? And whereas if you have a parameter, if you have a compact representation, you essentially might be able to compute. So now when you do the compact representation, you have put a bias, because after all, in the big bad world, there could be value functions which essentially are completely independent of each cell surround. I mean, all the value functions are basically like barely dependent on each other, values of the cells. In that case, you don't expect any parameterization to help. So in when you are trying to look for, let's say, a parameterized representation for either the action model or the value model or the policy, in essence, you're making a bias. You're saying it will take the function that I'm talking about. I mean, tabular representation is a representation of function. There's nothing wrong with tabular representation, except what I'm saying is I'm looking for lines. My function is a linear function. Then we know what to do. You know, plot the points, find the best fit. Anything which is not close to the line, just assume it's noise. And that's a bias. Okay? So you can get there, in a sense, by starting to talk about value functions. I mean, in fact, we don't even talk about models right now. We'll talk about value functions in a parameterized form. To do that, so essentially we'll provide a value function as an actual closed form function of some kind, and then you're trying to approximate, find an approximate representation for that. Okay? And then you will have a bias. You need a bias. The question, what the bias we will have oftentimes in reinforcement learning is you look for linear functions. Linear functions in what? It can't be in terms of state names, because all we had until now is state names. You know, if I have a function whose input is the state number, there were 10,000 different inputs, and you are back to the square one. What you need is the states have to have internal structure. You need features, which is what we were doing several weeks back. We did that as a minimum. You know, every state is represented in a state variable model. Okay, we talked about Boolean state variables, but in general, all you want is, it can be continuous state variables. In machine learning parlance, state variables are features. Okay, except one of the interesting things is, we thought when we were doing state variables in the previous classes, we assumed that state variables are given as part of the domain description. And then you went from there. In machine learning parlance, in these kind of cases, you assume that some human sat down and wrote down the right features. That's cheating to some extent. But you have to do, you know, essentially, they start by engineering the features and then hope that in that feature universe, there is a linear function. Why linear function? Because finding lines is easy, right? Because in essence, function fitting essentially involves minimizing the error. Okay, so the idea is, you know, if you have some sort of an n-dimensional data, you know, which to make it easy to show, I'll do two-dimensional data, right? Then I'm trying to find a line that best fits this data. The basic idea is, okay, here is one line, here is another line, here is a third line. Which one do you think is better? You would say the middle, I hope. Right? Okay, but I'm not going to ask you, I'm not going to draw the lines and ask you which one is better. In essence, I can, for each of these lines, I can compute their error, which is, for each of these points, there is an x value. Given the x value, the line predicts the y value. You take the real y value and what the line predicted. So notice that this line isn't going through this point at all. But in a way, this point's x value is here. So according to this line, this point should have value 0 as the y value. So this much is the error for that point. Right? And then what you are essentially going to do is minimize this error, minimize the cumulative error. And since the errors can be both positive and negative, sometimes you overestimate the y, sometimes you underestimate the y, the normal thing you do is you square them, add them up, minimize it. Now if I give you a function and you want to minimize it, what do? You take its derivative and you set it to equal to 0. Okay? And more interestingly, you can take its derivative and make a step, a baby step, in the direction opposite to the direction of the derivative. Now what's interesting is when I do this, remember these, you know, all of you know is y equal to mx plus c, right? All lines are y equal to mx plus c form. So in another way of thinking about it is that you know, a times x plus b times y minus plus c is the line. So what I'm trying to find, or in fact I'll say weight 1 times x plus weight 2 times y plus weight 3. What I'm trying to find is these weights. If I change the weights, I go from this line to this line to this line. And it's these weights that you are changing when you make baby steps in the gradient space. Right? So that's all we're going to do. And you have done this in the past, except now you're doing this with respect to the value function. So what I'm going to say is these crosses that you just saw, think of them essentially as the, so let's say if it's a one-dimensional, if this is a one-dimensional state space, that means there's only one feature, right? If there's only one feature, then this is the x feature and this is the value. This is the feature of that state and this is the value for that state. If it is two-dimensional, if there are two features, then it will be a three-dimensional picture. If there are five values, it will be a six-dimensional picture. And you basically, the line that you are computing will be an hyperplane. The best line would be the best hyperplane that has the lowest error with respect to the point. And you can find that best hyperplane just by gradient descent. Yes, sir. What? Yeah, these are linear functions, linear with respect to the features. No, features, x and y. Weights are just numbers. So for example, if I give you x square plus y square equal to r square, okay, that would be w1, which is 1, times x square plus w2, which is 1, times y square equal to r square. That is no longer a line. That's a circle. So when you say linear versus nonlinear, you are talking in terms of the feature. And all your the weights are essentially the coefficients for the feature.
When you try to classify linearly acceptable data, and that point of time you go for nonlinear models, right?
That's a different story. So right now I'm doing the baby step. I'm basically doing linear separability. Now there are, so you might ask, what if the features that I picked for my state space are such that there is no line that is a best fit? So in fact, there are all these jokes, right, that psychologists are always able to find lines. So suppose my function is like this. I can still draw a line, actually. That's a pretty good line. But you may not like that. In fact, my function is like this. then I still can draw a line. That's not going to be a good line. So the interesting question is, what do you do in those cases? How do you get, you know, if it's not linearly separable, what do you do? Well, the idea is you are making the feature. Make better features such that it will be linearly separable. Okay? So it turns out that if you make a circle in terms of x and y coordinates, if you're thinking of a circular classifier, right? If you're thinking of x and y, circle will look like this, and obviously it's not a line. But if you made features, three-dimensional features, x square, y square, square root of xy. For any x and y values, you know these three coordinates. If you plot these coordinates, then what happens is you will get a nice hyperplane in this three-dimensional space, such that below would be the inside of the circle, above would be outside of the circle, or vice versa. Now, who is the clever guy? Me, because I made these x squares and y squares and root xy. In general, when you do feature engineering, you can always find the feature such that with respect to those features, it's linear. This is why, in fact, in many, many situations where we think that, oh, there are not that many linear problems in the world, and yet people seem to be using linear techniques, the reason is people find features such that it will become a linear problem. Sometimes it becomes hard, then you may actually have to do nonlinear. Okay? So what is the idea that does this automatically for you? How many of you have done machine learning courses? How many of you would like your grade to be taken away? All of you, unless you give me the answer right away. Kernel-based methods. Kernel-based methods essentially do this automatically for you. Sort of. It's a joke, actually. They don't really do. But, you know, they can act as if they're trying to do it to some extent, because in essence, for example, if you define the right kind of distance matrix between points, then kernel-based methods will work. But what you really want to know is this, that all data is linearly separable if you increase the dimensionality. That's where the kernel-based methods come. Because there is some subspace in this high dimensional space where they are actually linearly separable. And so you can also say, if I human engineer the feature, then it will be linearly separable. So for example, think about earthquake 6 and 7 and 8. That's not a linear feature. 7 is exponentially bigger earthquake than 6. 7 decibels are exponentially more sound than 6 decibels. But our eardrums are essentially bad. They can only figure out exponential differences, not linear differences. So I think in terms of decibel features instead of thinking in terms of the normal intensity. So I am taking, you know, log, so that it will become linear again. We do this all our lives. Okay? So now I'll come back next class. I mean, I just gave you my philosophy of machine learning, which is you cheat by making up features. You know, I mean, nobody will tell you this, but that's exactly what you do in most cases. Okay? If your method works, you made up the features. One of the questions in AI is, can we also make the features automatically? That's a very interesting point. But at least for next class, we will cheat like the rest of them, and then try to say that if you have sort of a linear function, you can essentially do online learning of the weights. So all the cube value updates, instead of updating the value function, will be updating the weights of a hyperplane. And it will, you know, basically, obviously, in essence, when you're updating the weights, you're also updating the values. Except the generalizability here is much higher, because when you change one weight, you're not just changing one value, you're changing a whole bunch of values. So for example, if there was a bad line and I changed one of its weights, it becomes this line. Now it's not just this particular point for which it's correct. Many other points are going to be affected. And so there is like implicit generalizability when you have this sort of a function. Okay, so this is sort of obvious, but we'll look at it again next class. So we'll talk about both Q-learning in the context of what is called, you know, parameterized functions, which does gradient descent. And then we'll also talk about policy learning in the context of parameterized policies. Now the interesting thing when you get to the policies would be values are already continuous quantities. So you can actually imagine values being written as a times x plus b times y plus c, which is a continuous function, where x and y are some random features. X could be the decibel. Y could be the square of the x coordinate plus cube of the y coordinate. Could be. Okay? But at least you can write this as a normal arithmetic function that can be differentiable. When you have policies, policies are by definition discrete, especially in the non-continuous cases, the ones that not, I mean, for the discrete cases that we're talking about, you know, policies are discrete, right? And so, for a small value change, policy suddenly changes, the action suddenly changes. They become non-continuous. So how do you actually do policy iteration when you have parameterized policy, which is discontinuous? What do? You make them continuous. Remember in the neural networks, instead of using step function, you use a sigmoid function. Why? Because sigmoid function is differentiable. That's it. And it looks sort of like a step function. Okay? So we find a cute way of representing policies in the softmax policies, such that they will do exactly what the normal policies do, probabilistically speaking, but they're differentiable. And once they are differentiable, you can do LMS ascent and descent. Okay? That's what we'll do. And then the policy change is the one that helicopter does.